Thank you, Peter. Hello, everyone. I'm going to sort of change the focus of what we've heard so far in the last few talks and the talk we just heard today. What we've been discussing is mainly communication between glial cells, either through ATP release or through IP3 mediated signals. And what I want to do is introduce a new variable into the soup, so to speak. I deal with neurons, and as you saw just in Eric's talk, neurons are near glial cells. And what a lot of what you've seen in the last few talks shows, here's a cell, here's a cell, here's a cell, and they seem to be in this black space. And what my focus is on is it's not just a black empty space. There's actually something called the extracellular matrix that surrounds all the cells. And it surrounds the neurons, it surrounds the glial cells, and it's part of the intact brain tissue. So up here we have one neuron, and there's an extended process that makes a synaptic contact with a second neuron. Over here is a third neuron. And what we're going to look at is how is the synapse functionality regulated. In particular, we're going to focus on a glutamate type receptor called the AMPA receptor, which is involved in learning and memory. And we're also going to look at how synaptic activity promotes cell survival. So synaptic activity, when the cells communicate, how does this communication signal from one cell to another that the cell should survive under conditions such as excitotoxicity, where the cell is overstimulated and there could be neuronal damage where the cell may die. Now the extracellular matrix becomes involved not only in synaptic plasticity but in neuronal maintenance. And because it's involved in these two functions, it plays a role possibly in cell survival when a cell is exposed to such an injury like a stroke or ischemia. And what we're going to look at are interactions that occur between the intra and extracellular matrices, and we're going to focus on the polysaccharide component of the extracellular matrix. Now here's a schematic showing a presynaptic neuron, a postsynaptic neuron, and all around the synapse and around the cells is the extracellular matrix with these cotton candy type proteoglycans and glycosaminoglycans. These are the polysaccharides in the extracellular matrix. And they're there for a reason. They help cells connect. They're a basement membrane for cells to grow on. If you're growing them in a dish, they also support cells in the brain. And when a presynaptic cell is stimulated, it can release glutamate, as we've heard before, but it can also release these polysaccharides, in particular the GAGs, the glycosaminoglycans. And it may do so in response to a signal where, for some reason, the synapse needs to be altered. This extracellular matrix needs more of these polysaccharides. So they're delivered to the synapse to help in synaptic function and maintaining the activity between the two cells. And we'll be looking today at glutamate receptors. There's NMDA, AMPA receptors, there's metabotropic, and there's also kainate receptors, which are not on the diagram. The NMDA receptors, when they're stimulated, they let calcium into the cell, and they can be blocked by the inhibitor AP5. And with AMPA receptors, when they're stimulated, they can let in both sodium and calcium ions into the cell. And it's their selectivity for either sodium or calcium is dependent on the subunit combination that makes up the AMPA receptor. And the activity of the AMPA receptor can be blocked by CNQX. And this is a diagram of a typical proteoglycan. It has a protein core and a hyaluronic acid binding region. And off the protein core are these highly sulfated GAGs or glycosaminoglycans. And today we'll be looking at one in particular, the dextran sulfate glycosaminoglycan, which is a highly sulfated molecule. And we're going to look at two different sizes. The DSL is a 500,000 molecular weight molecule and the DSS, which is a 5,000 molecular weight molecule. And we'll also be looking at a non-sulfated form of this dextrin. So in the first part, we're going to look at how this glycosaminoglycan, this dextrin sulfate, may affect AMPA receptor function when it's part of the synapse, when it's added to the synapse. And we'll be looking at changes in channel kinetics, binding affinity, and receptor function. The first part, the channel kinetics, we're going to take AMPA receptors, isolate them from a rat brain, and reconstitute them into an artificial bilayer and do electrophysiology recordings on these individual AMPA receptors. And we're going to not only stimulate them with the AMPA agonist, but also with our glycosaminoglycan, dextrin sulfate. And we're going to be looking at sulfate and size-dependent components of the modulation of the channel kinetics by the dextrin molecule. Now, on the top here, we have the control. We're looking at single channel events. So it's one AMPA receptor. When the AMPA receptor is activated, the channel opens and ions flow through. So we're measuring ion flux through the channel. And when there's no stimulation, the single channels remain closed. When we add the agonist, we see these inward deflections, which represent open channel events. When we add a non-sulfated dextrin or the small DSS molecule, we don't see much of a significant change from the AMPA by itself. But when we put in the large DSL molecule, we see an increase in the amount of time that the channel is open. We see many more deflections that are downward, indicating open single channel events. And we also see that the probability of this channel being open increases. And finally, the whole effect can be blocked by the specific AMPA inhibitor, CNQX.
So
yes.
These are in artificial membrane?
Yeah, so they're just isolated AMPA receptors that were purified and put into the lipid bilayer, artificial bilayer. And here we have a graph representing a number of traces where the no treatment, the channels, probability of being open is nearly zero. When we add AMPA, we increase the open probability with little change by the sulfate-free dextrin and also by the small dextrin molecule. But when we add the DSL, the very large, highly sulfated molecule, we see about a fourfold increase in the probability that these channels will open. And we also can measure the amount of time that the channels open when it's stimulated. Here we have the AMPA agonist stimulating the channels to open, and it's about 4 milliseconds with no change by the sulfate-free dextrin or by the small DSS molecule. And then when we add the large, highly sulfated dextrin molecule, we see an increase to about 8 or 9 milliseconds, and we can block that with the CNQX. So we're showing that there is a size and sulfate-dependent component to how DSL modulates AMPA receptor function. Next, we wanted to look at binding affinity for the reason that if you alter channel kinetics, you may also alter other properties of the receptor. And we're going to look again for the size and sulfate dependent effect of DSL on such properties like binding affinity. So here we have AMPA receptors that were isolated from the rat brain, and they're still on the membranes, and we're looking at binding affinity. So we have the agonist, it binds to the receptor, and we want to see when we use the addition of dextrin sulfate, do we change that binding affinity of the agonist and the receptor? When we have the sulfate-free dextrin, we don't see a change in the binding affinity. However, when we increase the concentrations of the large dextrin molecule, we do see a decrease in the binding affinity. And with the smaller DSS molecule, we see a minimal change in the binding affinity. So people have published reports indicating that if you change the kinetics and change the binding affinity of a receptor, you're also most likely going to alter receptor function. So we wanted to look at the function of the AMPA receptors by using a calcium influx assay with the Flo3 dye that we've all seen in the past few days. And we're going to stimulate an AMPA response, measure the calcium changes in the cells, and then we're going to put in the DSL, the large molecule, or the sulfate-free dextran, or even the small molecule, and see what effects there are on receptor function when these different sulfate and size-dependent molecules exist.
Yeah. Okay, let me, I'm not sure if you're going to get to this, but the binding affinity, would that affect the desensitization, and that could account for the open time?
Yeah. It's a possibility. I wasn't going to delve into it, but yes. So what we're going to look at are hippocampal cells, and it's a dissociated hippocampal cell culture, meaning that we took the hippocampus out of the rat brain. We treated it with enzymes to make single cell monolayer cultures. And what we did was we treated the cells with Flo3 dye and then added the AMPA agonist after washing out the dye. And as we increase the concentration of the AMPA, we see an increase in calcium uptake in the cells. So these are cells that are in a 96-well plate. We're not looking at individual cells. We're actually using a fluorimeter to measure the fluorescence intensity of a population of cells. So these values are for 8 wells of cells all averaged out together. And we can also block this response with the inhibitor CNQX, which is specific for AMPA. And here we went to the confocal to see which types of cells are having an AMPA response. So in this left-hand picture, we have a neuron here, one here, and one here, and we've treated them only in saline conditions. So there's really nothing to stimulate the AMPA receptor, and this is the background fluorescence from the Flo3 dye. And when we add the AMPA to stimulate the cells, we see that we get an increase in calcium not only in the cell bodies, but along the processes, and even at synaptic contacts between the neurons. So what I'll do is I'll show you the movie that these came from, and you can have a look and watch how the changes in the calcium progress through the cell. So here they are just in saline, and now we've added AMPA, and the intensity starts here and moves along the processes.
The AMPA's in the back.
Yes, it's bathed over them. It's perfused onto the cells. Okay, so...
Can you show that again?
Can I show that? I think so. Too far. Okay. So what we have so far is that we have an AMPA response in our cells. And what we want to know is, how does this extracellular matrix molecule, this dextran sulfate, affect the AMPA response? And we did some experiments with the fluorimeter and the 96-well plate full of hippocampal cells. Using our Flo3 dye, we treated the cells in a calcium-rich external environment and a calcium-free external environment. And what we saw was that when we put the AMPA, we have the response as we expected because we saw it in the confocal images. And when we put the DSL and co-applied it with the AMPA agonist, we saw an enhancement of the AMPA response. So this was sort of what we expected, since the binding kinetics and the channel kinetics and the binding affinity were changed when we had this large molecule present. And now we're showing, yeah. Chondroitin sulfate, dermatan sulfate, keratin sulfate. The dextran sulfate is not a constituent. It's a heparin analog. So heparin is one that's normally found in the brain. So it's similar to heparin.
So you're adding it to these cells that already have the
right.
Present.
Right, so we're actually adding extra to the cell to see how that affects what's happening with the receptors.
And what's the rate of internalization on that?
As far as I know, I haven't seen a report yet that says it gets internalized. It seems to stay outside because it's such a large molecule. It doesn't seem to go in. So we have a signal with our calcium-rich environment, and when we remove the external calcium, we lose the signal, not only with the DSL present, but also with the AMPA agonist. So these data suggest to us that the calcium, the enhancement of calcium influx that we're seeing with the dextran sulfate, is coming directly from the outside through the AMPA receptor open channel and into the cell, as opposed to being a release of internal calcium stores that might be affected by the dextran sulfate. And here's some more confocal images, and we've got several neurons in the field. And what we're looking at here is already we're at the 60 micromolar response, the AMPA response in our cells. These are treated with Flow-3. And when we add the DSL, we see in some, but not every neuron, an increase in fluorescence intensity that can be blocked by CNQX. So not only does the AMPA, as we saw in the graph previous, the AMPA causes a calcium influx, but the DSL can enhance that calcium influx, and we can visualize that. In the next couple of graphs that I'm going to show you, what we're going to look at is the AMPA response as a 0% change, and then we're going to look at anything that enhances the AMPA response will be an increase above that 0%. It'll be a positive percent change. And anything that we see below or is blocking the response will be a negative percent change. So here we have AMPA by itself, and here's the control, the zeroed response. When we put CNQX in, we block the AMPA response, and we put in the NMDA inhibitor AP5, we don't see much change from the control. And the reason we did these experiments is because when you put AMPA agonist into the culture or bathe the cells in this agonist, you depolarize the membrane. And what could happen when you depolarize the membrane is that NMDA channels can open and calcium could be coming in through those. So they may have been contributing to the effects that we were seeing. They could be contributing this additional calcium with the DSL, or they could be contributing calcium to the original AMPA response. So here we've determined that when we put our AMPA agonist on, very little to no involvement of the calcium channels or the NMDA channels letting calcium in occurs. And the same is true when the DSL is present. Here we have our control where DSL is enhanced, the typical AMPA agonist response, and then we can block this with CNQX, but not with AP5. So again, NMDA receptors are not contributing to the calcium response that we're detecting. And again, the size and sulfate-dependent effects that we saw with the channel kinetics and the binding affinity have played a role not in the receptor function as well. So we see here the large sulfated dextran molecule. When we increase the dose, we see an increase in the enhancement of the AMPA response. When we put in the small DSS, we see no significant change until we get to very high concentrations of 1 micromolar, where we see some change where the enhancement of the AMPA response occurs, but certainly not as much as when the molecule is 500,000 molecular weight versus this 5,000 molecule. And finally, the sulfate-free dextran has no effect on the AMPA response. So we're seeing, again, that size and sulfate-dependent component to the activity, the modulation of the AMPA receptors. So here's just a schematic to recapture what we've gone over, the presynaptic neuron, the postsynaptic neuron. Here we have the extracellular matrix, and we have these highly sulfated glycosaminoglycans and proteoglycans. And what we think is happening is they're somehow interacting directly with the AMPA receptor to alter the receptor function. And in our case, through the measurements, we see that it's increasing calcium uptake in the cells. So when you have an increase in calcium inside the cells, Many times this will activate different pathways. As you have seen in the talks, we've had IP3 activity and ATP is released, glutamate neurotransmitters are released. And one other thing that can happen is that inside the cell, there are signaling pathways that can be activated for cell survival. So if you take a cell and you injure the cell, in this case, we're going to give it an excitotoxic insult. We're going to apply large amounts of agonist for long periods of time and injure the cell. We're going to cause it to be excitotoxic or simulate a stroke or an ischemic event by giving this excitotoxic insult. And we're going to do this in dissociated hippocampal cell cultures with the DSL or without the DSL present as we cause the injury. And we're going to look for a correlation between this modulation by this extracellular molecule and the neuroprotection that we do end up finding is present. And then we're going to confirm and also take this a bit further with the hippocampal slice culture system that we heard about yesterday. And this is the hippocampus removed from the rat brain and cut up into slices that are 200 microns thick. And these are cultured on inserts. And what we can do with these that we can't do with the hippocampal cells, the dissociated cells, is look more at the maintenance of synaptic integrity, because these slices represent something more similar to the intact brain, whereas the dissociated cells, we disrupt every connection that's there and then we throw them in a dish and they have to make new connections. So the hippocampal slice culture tends to be a very good model system if you want to see similarities that could be happening in the intact brain as well. And what we'll do is we'll look at the maintenance of synaptic integrity and a link to MAP kinase, which is a survival signaling pathway in the cells. So our dissociated hippocampal cell system uses, this assay uses an enzyme or an Ens-Check dye that measures protease activity. So you put the Ens-Check dye in the cells, and when proteases are activated, they cause the fluorescence of the dye. And what we're going to look at again, as I said, with and without the DSL present, do we get some sort of protection when this dextran sulfate is in the culture? So first we did a time course looking at AMPA causing injury to the cells, and we found that at 24 hours we had our greatest increase in membrane permeability. And what we're looking at is the protease dye. When we put the AMPA agonist on, we're causing injury to the cells. We're overly exciting the cells. Proteases become activated. That's one of the first signs of neurodegeneration. And membrane permeability becomes compromised due to the protease activation. So this is how we're going to measure whether or not we have injury or protection in our dissociated cell system.
Permeability to what?
Everything. To everything. So basically the architecture of the membrane becomes compromised and anything or everything can come in and out. So here we have the AMPA agonist on for 24 hours causing large increases in membrane permeability. We can block it with CNQX, but somewhat block it with AP5, but not completely protect the neuron. And here on the outside is a calpain inhibitor, CX25. And calpain is a calcium-dependent enzyme that is activated during these excitotoxic insults. So this is put in as a control to show that we are creating the insult and we can't stop the insult by protecting the cells from things such as calpain.
Generally, it's thought that the only activation of NMDA receptors causes neurotoxicity. So why are these cells different? AMPA activation, or is this generally true?
In the hippocampus, yes, it's generally true. Actually, both NMDA and AMPA can cause excitotoxicity. And here we have a light micrograph image of the cells on the dish with extended processes, making contacts. This is all the no treatment, so this is what we expect our culture to look like. Here we've added the AMPA for 24 hours, basically to injure the cells, and we've caused cell death, and you can see some of the cells are still surviving. They have processes that extend out from their cell bodies, but there are others that have just rounded up and retracted their cell bodies, and they've become much darker and don't let the light reflect off of them. So these are cells that are either dying or are already dead due to the AMPA overexcitability. And down here, we see that we have cells surviving not only in the presence of the dextran sulfate, but also when we add an AMPA inhibitor CNQX. So this was of interest because most research will tell you if you've got an excitotoxic receptor, whereas we're stimulating the AMPA receptor, if we just shut it off, we'll save the cells. But here we're finding that if we just enhance their activity a little bit, even though we've got this excitotoxicity going on, we can still protect them. So this was an interesting finding. There are fewer contacts. Yeah, you lose them when you have the AMPA present. These are with AMPA present. So they're both the AMPA and the DSL for the 24 hours. So again, we wanted to see, do we have that size and sulfate dependent component that's happening in the channel kinetics and in the binding affinity and also in the receptor function when we have our DSL or the sulfate-free dextran present? And here we have a reduction in AMPA-induced membrane permeability. So here's our control where we've got AMPA creating membrane permeability or neuron damage. We can block that damage with CNQX and block some of it with AP5, but not all of it. And when we put DSL in with the AMPA, we see that we can block it to about the same levels as CNQX, but the small sulfated molecule cannot do that. And what was interesting is this is a heparin monomer, and as I said earlier, dextran sulfate is a heparin analog, so it has to be a polymer and not a monomer in order for it to be effective. So it's got to be this large molecule. And also sulfates by themselves don't really have any protective effect. No, just the monomer. But I have seen reports that heparin can be protective too. So now we have our data is telling us that we have protection in our dissociated hippocampal cells. And we saw earlier that we had, when we put DSL in, we enhanced the AMPA response. So we wanted to look to see if there was a correlation between this receptor modulation, this enhancement of the AMPA response, and the neuroprotection that we were seeing. And what we found when we put everything side by side, here on the left is the block of the neuronal damage. So instead of showing you membrane permeability, now we're showing you protease inhibition. So we're looking at neuronal block here where we're blocking the protease inhibition, which will prevent the membrane permeability from happening. And over here we have the AMPA receptor modulation. This is our calcium influx that we saw earlier. And this is a full dose response. And what we saw was that the large dextran sulfate not only protects the cells from neuronal damage, but also enhances the calcium in these cells, whereas the sulfate-free dextran has no effect on either property. And the small dextran sulfate does not protect, even though it does increase calcium. So the theory is perhaps there's a threshold level of calcium that's necessary to provide this neuroprotection, because the dextran, the large molecule, the large dextran sulfate, can increase the calcium more effectively than the small. So on to our second system with the slice cultures and looking at something that's more like intact brain tissue. We wanted to see if we had links to maintaining synaptic integrity. During an excitotoxic insult, the cell becomes compromised, and we lose the synaptic integrity, which means that we lose presynaptic components, we lose postsynaptic components, and the cells no longer can communicate to one another, which is part of the destruction process and the neurodegeneration. So we're going to look at presynaptic marker called synapsin and two postsynaptic markers. One is GluR1, that's one of the AMPA receptor subunits, and this other is spectrin breakdown, which is an early sign of neurodegeneration. Spectrin is part of the intracellular cytoskeleton, and that becomes chewed up when cells are exposed to injuries such as excitotoxicity. And here we have our hippocampal cells were treated for 30 minutes with an excitotoxic agonist, a glutamate agonist, and then this excitotoxicity was stopped. And then for 24 hours following the excitotoxic injury, we applied the large dextrin sulfate. And what we found was in the no treatment, these are the average levels for synapsin 1A and 1B, which are isoforms of synapsin. When we apply the insult, we see a decrease in the synapsin. And when we put the DSL in during the recovery period from the injury, we get restoration to near control levels. So it's suggesting that dextran sulfate in this post-recovery period is somehow helping the neuron to recover. And again, here with the spectrin breakdown and the GluR1, this is our no treatment. There's no insult, so we don't expect any spectrum breakdown. We do expect to have good levels of GluR1, our AMPA receptor, at the postsynaptic membrane. When we put our insult for 30 minutes and then look 24 hours after without any treatments, we see that we have a large increase in spectrum breakdown and a decrease in the GluR1, the number of AMPA receptors at the postsynaptic membrane. And then if DSL is present in this 24-hour recovery period, we see that, again, we go back to the no treatment levels for both markers. So we know that dextran sulfate not only protects neurons during an excitotoxic insult, it can protect them afterwards as well, as we've just seen with the Western blots. And finally, we want to know, what is the mechanism? We know that it's activating calcium. Is there some sort of calcium signaling pathway that could be occurring to help support this data showing that we can protect the cells from such an injury? And MAP kinase is one such cell survival pathway that's known to, one of the ways to activate it is through an increase in intracellular calcium. So we looked at whether or not the large dextran sulfate could cause the phosphorylation or activation of MAP kinase, in particular ERK1 and ERK2, which are extracellular signal-related kinases. And what we found was that when we have the DSL present, we get an increase in this phosphorylated MAP kinase, and we also can block it with inhibitors that block the phosphorylation of the ERK or the MAP kinase molecule. And what was really interesting was that when we did our CNQX, our AMPA-specific inhibitor, we blocked the phosphorylation of the pERK. But when we put the NMDA inhibitor, AP5, we don't block the effects of DSL. So this suggests to us that not only does the dextran sulfate interact directly with AMPA receptors, it's doing so to change the channel kinetics and the binding affinity, which affect receptor function, which now seems to affect downstream events within the cell following an excitotoxic injury. We can see that there's protection and it's possibly mediated by MAP kinase. So that's what we're seeing here is the presynaptic. We have the stimulation of the cells, the AMPA receptor with the proteoglycan and the GAG interacting can increase the intracellular calcium to be linked or possibly activate MAP kinase and leads to cell survival. So in conclusion, we've found so far that dextran sulfate positively modulates AMPA receptor activity and regulates channel kinetics and binding, that it enhances the AMPA-mediated calcium response in the hippocampal neurons, and that it may be linked to the maintenance of synaptic integrity and also the MAP kinase survival pathway. And finally, I just want to acknowledge some folks who are at the University of Connecticut as well as Cognetics, who've all participated in the data that I've just presented. Thank you.
Questions?
So you mentioned that GAGs are released from presynaptic terminals. What's known about that? They're in vesicles?
They're in vesicles. They're packaged up presynaptically, kind of like a neurotransmitter, and they're in the vesicles. And when the extracellular environment is in need of the GAGs, which I'm not sure what the signals are that tell the cell to release it, but it becomes released through these vesicles, just like a neurotransmitter.
So they're not released at the same time as the transmitters. It's not a voltage-dependent release, or
no. It's some other signal. Sometimes what happens is the cells in the surrounding area will dump gagases, which are basically the enzymes that chew up the GAG. So it can alter the structure. It can chew up ones that it doesn't want in the synapse. The cell can send out these gagases, and then it can replenish with a different type of GAG. So it can change the composition of the extracellular matrix for things like learning and memory, where things are changing constantly to make the connections.
And do you think the main effect on the receptor is by altering the binding of the agonist?
I think so. I think because the binding is altered, the kinetics become altered, and then we see this change in the functional activity. So I think, yeah, one relates to the other, and then it causes a different response in the cell because it's there and it interacts.
Is anything more known about that kind of interaction on a molecular level?
Not really. The only thing that's comparable is an AMPA-kine, which is a drug that's been made by Cortex, actually, in California. And what that does is it stimulates the AMPA receptor in much in a similar way, where it's a low-level stimulation. It's not this over-excitotoxicity, but it gives a low-level stimulation, kind of like the glutamate that just sort of diffuses to keep neuronal contacts maintained during the normal life cycle of the cells. But it has this low-level effect on the AMPA receptors, and it has its effects because it activates the AMPA receptor have been linked to this MAP kinase survival pathway following an excitotoxic injury. So it's kind of, they're looking at this molecule because it may help in Alzheimer's for learning and memory, where we lose the connectivity. This AMPA-kine could come along, it could interact with the AMPA receptor. There's actually binding sites for it on the AMPA receptors, and stimulate the AMPA receptor so that the contacts are maintained and people don't lose their memories. This connection doesn't become severed due to inactivity. So it's similar in a way to that molecule, but not much for other glycosaminoglycans in the brain as far as this type of work.
I just had a really quick question. And that is, you said that the GAGs or proteoglycans are in the vesicles. Are they GAGs or are they GAGs with their cores?
They can be both. They can exist in both forms. So it can be the proteoglycan and also the free glycosaminoglycan.
And when you say that there's a shift during injury, are you seeing a shift from these sort of low molecular weight HSPGs or low molecular weight PGs to high molecular weight, sort of this same injury response that you see in some of these amyloid diseases?
Not so much a shift in size, but a shift either in types of, it may shift from dermatan sulfate, which might have been the high level native GAG, to chondroitin sulfate, which then has a separate effect and can cause the cell to respond and survive an injury. So a lot of times in an injury, people who have studied chondroitin sulfate have shown that there is an upregulation of this GAG and or this proteoglycan in order to respond to the injury and help the cell survive, especially in a glutamate excitotoxic event.
So is it known that any of these specific GAG, I mean, in reference to Eric's question, I mean, did they have higher, any specific ones have higher binding affinity to any of the different neurotransmitters, or?
It may be known, but I don't know the answer to that question.
Just curious.
Going back to the basic question of excitotoxicity, are AMPA receptors as effective
in triggering excitotoxicity as NMDA receptors?
From what I've gathered in the literature, yes. They both can be just as effective at causing the excitotoxicity. Blocking both of them will stop the excitotoxicity.
Aren't there findings that if you block NMDA receptors, it blocks excitotoxicity?
Yeah. Yeah, and the same is true for AMPA receptors, which is why this sort of a finding is odd, because it's kind of counterintuitive. You're enhancing the AMPA receptor, yet you're still getting survival.
Yeah.
So it's tough to sort out completely. I mean, our theory is there may be some sort of different type of AMPA receptor that is yet unknown that this dextran sulfate may be affecting, you know, a different subunit composition where it's affecting more of the calcium permeable versus the sodium permeable, or, you know, it's all up in the air. We haven't really looked into it.
Other questions? Comments?
If that's not the case, let's thank the speaker again. And close for lunch, I would say.